The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everyone who made it out in the rain. I just got here. It was not fun driving through the rain, but I'm glad that you guys did come. I'm really excited to see that there are actually people here. And I'm sure, I hope a lot of you have questions about Pretty Little Liars and The Lying Game. I guess to start off, I will tell you about the Pretty Little Liars series and The Lying Game series, and then read you an excerpt from The Lying Game, which is the first book in the series that has come out. So Pretty Little Liars, if you guys don't know, is a show that's now on ABC Family, but before that, it was an 8-book series, which will now be 12 books, in case none of you guys don't know. There are going to be 4 more. It is basically about 5 best friends, Aria, Spencer, Hannah, Emily, and Allison, who in 7th grade were inseparable. They did everything together. And Allison was their leader, and she was not a very nice girl. She hoarded secrets about them and held them over their heads and kind of teased them, and she sort of had them in her power. She was like the puppet master, which is kind of why the covers of the books are the girls looking like dolls, and Allie is the puppet master of the dolls. So anyway, on the last day of 7th grade, the girls have a sleepover, and everything is going sort of well. Allie is picking on them as usual, and all of a sudden, Allie goes missing, and nobody knows what happens to her. For 3 long years, you know, we don't know if she died, we don't know if she was kidnapped, we don't know if she ran away. And 3 years later, the remaining friends have grown apart. So they've all sort of gone and done their different things. And they start getting messages from somebody known as A. And maybe you guys know about A. A knows about secrets from today and from the past. So they think, who is A? Who is this person? Is it Allison? Is it somebody else? And the series pretty much goes from there, and there are a lot of twists and turns, and I'm happy to say that there are a lot of twists and turns in the show as well. And like I said, there are going to be 4 more Pretty Little Liars. I finished book 9. I'm starting on book 10, and I'm a little bit sad because, you know, now I want there to be like 8 more Pretty Little Liars because I love writing them. And then the second series that I came out with, which also is going to be a series on ABC Family, is called The Lying Game. And it is another murder mystery, a lot like Pretty Little Liars. The difference is that there are 2 narrators. They are identical twins, and one of the girls is alive, and one of the girls is dead. The girl who's alive, her name is Emma. And the twins were separated, so they never knew about one another until one fateful day. So Emma, who's still alive, led a very hard life. She was in foster care. She never really had a family. Sutton, the twin who is dead, had a very privileged life. She got everything that she wanted. She had lots of friends. She had a boyfriend. You know, she had a stable life. But Emma is forced into taking over Sutton's life and figuring out who her killer might be. So it's a little bit different for me to write this new series because there are 2 different narrators versus Pretty Little Liars, which there are 4 and they're all sort of, well, they're all alive. But, you know, the other thing that's a bit different is that I think The Lying Game is more of a hardcore murder mystery. Emma is really actively searching for her sister's killer. And, you know, she whereas in Pretty Little Liars, it's kind of like the girls are just searching for A. They want to know what happened to Allison, but really they just want whoever A is to shut up. And the Lion Game is much more like Emma has a lot of motivation to find her sister's killer because she wants to go back and live her own life. Because she's trapped right now into her sister's life. She can't tell anybody who she really is. So it's a little, you know, it's more compelling in that way, I think. And I have written, there are going to be four books in the series, and I have written the second one of that. So I've been pretty busy. But what I'm going to do is read you guys an excerpt from The Lion Game, and then usually I get a lot of questions. Now, I don't know because there aren't that many of you today in this horrible weather. Then I will answer, you know, questions about the series and, you know, talk about TV. I have lots of TV stories because I visited the set and I had a cameo. Or, you know, anything else, you know, if you want to talk about writing, if you want to talk about anything, you know, ask me, you know, what my favorite kind of cake is or whatever. So what I'm going to read is, let's see if I can find the page. It's kind of in the middle of The Lion Game, and it is a section on Emma is already very much in her sister's life, and she's hanging out with her friends. She is, she's sleeping in Sutton's bedroom. She's got Sutton's boyfriend. She's tried to leave once before, but Sutton's friends called and kind of stopped her from doing that. So, you know, she's kind of stuck. And this is just a really scary moment where Emma realizes that she really, really has to stay. And she realizes that also her sister's killer might be a lot closer than she thinks. So it's not too many pages, and then we will go on to talking about anything else. So, all right. Oh, and Emma is at a... So right now she is at a sleepover with Charlotte, Madeline, and Laurel, who and the Twitter twins. These are all of Sutton's friends. But everybody's asleep. It's just they've done all their sleepover things, and now it's sort of the middle of the night. The other thing about Emma is that she still kind of thinks... Her friends are big pranksters, so she thinks that maybe Sutton is actually alive because... she really doesn't know if Sutton is alive or dead. Somebody has told her that she's dead, but, you know, in Pretty Little Liars fashion, who knows? So you'll see a couple of moments here where it seems like, you know, maybe Sutton is playing a trick on her, perhaps. And the other thing that you might notice in this section, I think it's probably, there's probably a mention, is that there is a first-person narrator who comes in, and that is Sutton, because she's watching Emma from beyond the grave and commenting and kind of urging her along. Although Sutton has no memory, so she can't remember who killed her, conveniently. So she can't tell us, the reader. All right, so I'm going to start with Emma's kind of creepy scene. Emma groped for her water glass, but she couldn't find it. She slid from the couch as quietly as she could and tiptoed out the door and down the stairs toward the kitchen. The marble floors in the foyer felt like ice cubes on the soles of her feet. An angular coat rack by the front door resembled a giant tarantula. Emma sucked in her breath and stepped toward a glowing light down the hall. The digital clocks above the microwave and stove shone a stoic green. A metal chandelier hung over the center island. Emma's skin prickled with a mix of fear and excitement. She cocked her head and listened for sounds of Sutton sneaking up on her. Breathing, giggling, waiting. But there was nothing. Emma grabbed a water glass from the cabinet and tried the faucet. The water dribbled noisily into the sink. Just as she swallowed the last of the water and turned for the stairs again, she heard a creak. She halted and peered around. Her heart thudded. The clocks ticked from 2:06 to 2:07 in perfect synchronicity. Another creak rang out. "Is someone there?" Emma whispered, her vision blurred in the darkness. And then, all of a sudden, there was a loud crashing sound. Pain shot through Emma's hip. She started to turn, but someone pushed her harder against the island and pressed a hand over Emma's mouth. The water glass slipped out of Emma's hand and clattered to the floor. Fear streaked through her, hot and messy. "Mmm!" she cried out. The person didn't pull away. A body pressed up against her, warm and close. "Don't you dare yell out," said a voice in her ear. It was raspy and indecipherable, a mere whisper. "What were you thinking? I told you to play along. I told you not to leave." Emma tried to whip around to see who it was, but the figure shoved her forward and pressed her cheek to the kitchen island. "Sutton's dead," the voice insisted. "Keep being her until I tell you different. And don't try and skip town again or you're next." Emma whimpered. The hand squeezed her wrist so hard she thought her bones might break. Then something cold and metallic encircled her neck. It grew tighter and tighter around her throat until Emma's windpipe began to collapse. Her eyes bulged. She flailed her arms, but the wire just constricted her throat even more. Emma fought for breath, but she couldn't inhale, couldn't swallow. As she thrashed up and down, her feet began to tingle. I stared in horror. My vision was clouded, just like my sister's. All I could tell was that the strangler had broad shoulders. But then the stranglehold around Emma's neck loosened. Whoever it was pulled Emma back up to standing. Bright spots danced in front of her eyes. Air rushed into her lungs again. She leaned over and coughed. "Now keep your head down and count to 100, the strangler went on. "Don't look up until you're done, or else." Trembling, Emma pressed her forehead to the island countertop and started to count. 1, 2. Footsteps rang out behind her. I strained to see who it was, but the figure was a dark shadow. 10, 11, Emma counted. A door slammed. Emma cautiously raised her head. The kitchen was as silent and unassuming as it had been 5 minutes ago. She tiptoed to the front door and peered out, but the strangler was gone. She bent over her knees for a moment, wheezing. As she stood up again, something knocked heavily against her collarbone. She cautiously groped her skin. Dangling from a chain around her throat was a round locket, Sutton's round locket, the one she'd looked for in Sutton's jewelry box but couldn't find, the one Sutton had been wearing in the snuff film. The chain fit perfectly in the red, freshly strangled indentations on Emma's neck. Emma's world turned upside down all over again. Sutton really was dead. There was no doubt about it now. Hot, wet tears dotted her eyes. Her shaky hand flew to her mouth and muffled a sob. She did a full 180, peering frantically into the kitchen doorway, the bookcase-filled study, the double staircase, the majestic front entrance of Charlotte's house. Her gaze locked on a shining, uninterrupted red beam above the doorway. Next to it was a security system keypad. A green light illuminated over the word "armed." Emma tiptoed to the device. She'd lived briefly with a foster family in Reno who had the same alarm system. They had a cabinet full of valuable antique Wedgwood china, and they made her four foster kids sleep in the same cramped bedroom. And Emma's foster brother had showed her how to use this. She hit the down arrow, and a list of times when the alarm had been armed and disarmed appeared. The last entry said armed, 8:12 p.m. It was from when Mrs. Chamberlain had shut the door after letting in Emma and Laurel. There was no record that the power outage had disabled the alarm after that, though. Nor did the log indicate that Mrs. Chamberlain had had to rearm the alarm system after the power snapped back on earlier tonight. There was no record that someone had tripped it either, which would have happened if the strangler had gotten in through the doors or the windows. So how had he gotten in? How had he gotten out? Emma raised her head, a cold, slippery feeling passing through her. Maybe there was no need to get past the alarms. Maybe the strangler had been inside the house to start with. She thought about the voice in her ear. I told you to play along. I told you not to leave. And then she thought about the call with Charlotte and Laurel today. Are you at the Greyhound station? Laurel had asked. Could it be? I was pretty sure it could be. I thought about the memory I'd just had, the broad-shouldered figure pulling me out of the trunk, the shock of red hair when she stepped into the light. Whoever had strangled Emma was indeed someone inside the house. It was one of my very best friends. So that is the line. Name. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, we're just going to do questions, if that's okay with you.
We'll get people microphones.
Awesome. Okay. So that is line game number one. Line game number two is out in August. Pretty Little Liars 9 is out in July. So I hope you guys have questions. Otherwise, I'll just stand up here and talk. So, anybody? Uh-huh. Do you have some water? Is there? Yeah. Aria Montgomery. You're inspired by Aria. Aria was actually the most like me. Hang on a second, my tag's hanging out. Aria was the most like me in high school. Thank you. I did not have an affair with an English teacher. But especially my junior and senior years, I was so sick of living in the suburbs in the same way that she was, especially in the books. She comes back from Iceland, and she is just like, I hate living here. This is so boring. Everybody is a cookie cutter. And it was exactly what I went through when I was that age. You know, and I think a lot of Arya's sort of artsiness and wanting to be different and not really feeling like she fits in. This is mostly in the book. It's a little bit in the show as well, but it's more in the books. You know, not feeling like the typical Rosewood girl that all the guys like. That was definitely straight from my own experiences growing up. I, you know, was sort of into being popular for like a year in seventh grade, and then I just kind of did my own thing, and I was really artsy and bought everything from the vintage store, and, you know, my mom, wished I shopped at the Gap and whatever, and I wore, like, old men's clothes and shopped at South Street, and I don't even know what South Street is like now, but back then, you know, it was kind of the edgy place to shop. So that's kind of where Arya comes from. You know, all of her family issues too kind of hit close to home. You know, I drew from some family situations there, and I have been to Iceland. I didn't live there on sabbatical like Arya did, but I did, my sister and I went on a vacation to Iceland once, and I thought, oh, how strange would it be if, like, somebody from the Pennsylvania suburbs, Philadelphia suburbs, you know, lived in Iceland for a while. It's pretty different. So that's kind of where that came from. But yeah, I mean, she very much, was a lot like me when I was growing up. More questions? Uh-huh.
Did you play a role in, like, the casting for Pretty Little Liars?
I didn't actually play a role in the casting. The way that it worked was I kind of got an email or a phone call from my editor saying, you won't believe this, but ABC Family is going to film a pilot of Pretty Little Liars. And I was like, you're kidding. And being that it all took place in LA and I live here, you know, I didn't really go out and pick and whatever. And I know a lot of people, I just kind of saw the pictures of the girls once they were cast. So I saw a picture of Arya, I saw a picture of Spencer, and I think it was always those same four girls. And yeah, I mean, some of the parents, the casting changed from the pilot that I saw to whatever got on TV, but it pretty much all stayed the same. I know a lot of people were a little bit annoyed at first because the girls in the show don't really look like the girls in the books, especially on the cover, or the way that I describe them. And, you know, when I just saw their pictures, I was a little weirded out by that too. I was like, yeah, but Emily has red hair and, you know, Spencer has blonde hair. But once I saw the pilot, I thought that they really captured those characters that I created. So, you know, Spencer was very type A, and Aria was very, you know, free-spirited. Hannah was, you know, she had sort of this dark, you know, past of feeling shameful, and now she's Miss Popular. I mean, it all just worked so well. So I kind of lost, you know, I didn't really care anymore what they looked like. But no, I did not have any say in any of the casting, and I do not write the scripts either. I know they read the books. You know, I know that they've read all of them. I know all the writers have read all of them, but pretty much it's just inspired by Pretty Little Liars. So, but I think they're doing a good job. I think we have.
Where did you first get the idea to write Pretty Little Liars?
Where did I first get the idea? It feels like so long ago. I actually started writing the series probably 6 years ago. And I've always liked mysteries, you know, murder mysteries or psychological thrillers where you don't really know what's going on. So I kind of started with that. I knew that I wanted to set something in suburban Philadelphia because I grew up here, and I thought, you know, I wanted sort of a perfect, you know, very pretty setting, but very dark secrets, you know, lurking underneath. And beyond that, I've always liked the ideas of stalkers. I just think stalkers are really interesting. And, you know, secrets. I think secrets as a writer, it's, you know, every book that I've written has lots and lots of secrets that people keep, and, you know, worry that the secrets will be exposed and that kind of thing. So, you know, it was not something that came to me all in one flash. And I worked with, you know, a lot of editors too, and there was a lot of brainstorming of, you know, how exactly does this work? And, you know, if the girl goes missing, what happened to her? So, you know, there was a lot of that. But it wasn't really based on anything in particular. It wasn't based on, you know, a real story. It wasn't based on, I never had a dead friend or, you know, I never was tormented by anybody called A. You know, I got a couple of anonymous notes in my day, you know, when I was a teenager. But they were not threatening, and probably I would turn them in to, like, the principal if they were. But, you know, so that's kind of where it came from. I mean, it sort of didn't, it didn't really, it was a lot just out of imagination and you know, the love of stalkers and mysteries. Do we have more questions? You pick. I don't care.
How did you decide to write 4 more books in the Pretty Little Liars series?
Well, that is the publisher. The publisher decides. Originally, Pretty Little Liars was supposed to be 4 books. It was supposed to be 1 through 4. And I planned out how those 4 books, you know, in the very beginning, what would happen in each of those 4 books, because there are a couple overarching mysteries that we have to build towards. So if any of you have read through the whole series, you'll know that there are several different A's. Because what happened when I was sort of halfway through writing book 2, the series had gone well, so the publisher decided to buy 4 more. So now I had 8 books that I was dealing with. So it was kind of like, I can't stretch this first A out for 8 books. I mean, readers are going to hate me if I do that. So I ended, you know, one of the A's at the end of book 4 and started a new A that gets even deeper and crazier into the mystery, starting with book 5. And then I really thought the series was over at book 8 last year, came out last year. And I would say around October of this year, the show had done so well that my publisher started talking, like, do you have really any thoughts about, you know, how you could extend this series? And And I didn't want to leave the series. I loved writing about these girls, and I loved writing about this place and this mystery and all that. So I was happy to say, oh, I can figure something out. And through a lot of brainstorming and a lot of talking to editors and all that, we figured out how to extend the series to 12. But it's never really my call. In fact, I wanted to do 5 more books. Because I had a plan for 5 more Pretty Little Liars, but the publisher said no. They have to stop at 4. I don't really know why. But for some reason, they thought 4 was a good number. So it's been a little bit of... I think I've made it work, but it has been a little bit like, oh, no, I have to write 4 more, and I have to figure out what to do. And it's been just been a lot of planning in advance. Do we have more? I know I have some more hands.
It seems like technology has played a big role in Pretty Little Liars.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, like, how would the book be different if it was, like, written like, in the 90s or something like that?
It would probably be very different. I mean, when I was in high school and even in college, you know, we had email in college. And we kind of had email in high school, but nobody had cell phones. I mean, nobody had texting and all that. So I think it still could have worked, I think. I think, A's big thing is leaving messages for the girls. And A has done that in a lot of different ways. Writing in the dew on the windshield and sending Emily an old love letter that she wrote to Allie. I know there are a million other things, you know, sending Hannah a picture of herself when she was younger or her evil stepsister. So I think it still could have worked, but I'm very happy that technology played, you know, a part in it, because I think technology is just becoming more and more prevalent in everybody's lives. So it's actually funny to go back and read some of the early books, you know, like book 1 or book 2, because they have all these old cell phones that, like, nobody would use anymore. You know, they don't have an iPhone, they don't have a BlackBerry. They're, like, pretty basic. You know, they maybe can take pictures. But, you know, I'm sure it's that typing on the keypad and, like, you know, with the numeric kind of, like, it takes you forever to write one word. So, yeah, I mean, I'm thrilled that technology got to play a big role. I think it plays a big role in The Lion Game, too, because the twins find each other through YouTube, and, you know, Emma searches for her sister on Facebook and all that stuff. So it's fun to bring that stuff in. It is a little scary, though, because technology moves so fast. And it's, you know, once I have a book out, it's almost like the technology in it is obsolete. But, you know, I try to stay on top of it. That was a good question.
Okay, so I know there are going to be 4 more books, because mm-hmm. I thought this one was going to be the last
right.
one.
Right.
But
we all did.
How did you come up with that ending? Because I was really, really surprised.
Do you mean like the epilogue, or do you mean like the ending, like the ending at the Poconos house? Or the whole thing. I mean, I can't talk too much about it because I don't know where, you know, if there are other readers of the series, I don't know, you know, where you are in the series. I will say, though, that I knew about that ending pretty early on. I knew that, you know, there would be that sort of showdown, that certain character was going to come back. It would end in, you know, almost death. that kind of fun stuff. I didn't know exactly where it was going to happen, but I would say from planning books 5 through 8, I usually know with each book how it's going to end. I don't know what's going to happen in the middle or, like, even in the beginning, but I usually know how each of them are going to end. And definitely 5 through 8, I mean, they have very big endings. I mean, a dead body is found, or, you know, a certain person comes back that you never thought would come back, you know, or somebody's killed. I mean, they all end in these very dramatic ways. And So I knew that that was going to happen, but I didn't quite know how it was going to work out. So I'm happy with the way it worked out. As for the epilogue, which that was just kind of I thought of that as soon as I was writing it. And it sort of mirrors the very beginning, the prologue in the very beginning. And it was just really fun to write that, but it leaves it very open-ended. And I'm kind of glad that I left it open-ended because, you know, never thought there were going to be books 9 through 12, but now that there are, and, you know, some of those questions are going to be answered. So, very exciting. There are always lots of questions. This is so nice.
Okay, so how do you come up, like, with the secrets that the girls have to keep or, like, the threats that they're getting?
I usually think of, like, the worst thing that could be happening to somebody. Oh, is this me? Oh, that's you. I mean, I'm trying to think of the secrets, you know. Like, when I was starting out with the four books, the secrets came to me all at once, and a lot of them were things that I knew people were going through. Like, you know, Aria, well, no, I didn't know anybody who was having an affair with a teacher, but I did know people who, whose family was sort of in turmoil, and, you know, what would that feel like to have a friend know about that and tease you about that? I certainly have had lots of friends who, in high school and in college and afterwards, have struggled with their sexuality, have had strict parents, and haven't known how to deal with that. You know, the story of Spencer's first secret with her sister Melissa, you know, everybody has a sister that they compete with. Now, I'm not sure I ever knew anybody who stole their sister's boyfriend and then, you know, her various boyfriends, but, you know. And then Hannah's story, actually, I had eating issues. Hannah's secret when she was, from when she was young was that she was bulimic. That was one of the things that Allie knew about her. And that was kind of based on my own experience. I wasn't bulimic, but I definitely had problems when I was growing up. You know, control eating issues, you know, just things like that. And I wanted to definitely create a character that was going through something like that and really show how it's about control and loneliness and not feeling good enough. And it's really not so much about having the celebrity body. It's more just a darker kind of, you know, thing that you have to go through and that's hard to go through. So those were the basic secrets. And I think those have carried through to later books. I mean, they've sort of changed, you know, and become other things, but I think getting the core secrets of the girls kind of made it easier to make up their later secrets, if that makes any sense. But it is fun making up the secrets because, you know, poor A then can torment them. And I don't like seeing these girls tormented, but, you know, they come through in the end. Do you have a... Oh, okay.
Yes, right here.
Uh-huh.
I have three daughters.
And okay.
One of them used to want to be like a scientist, and but now she wants to be a writer.
Okay.
So what types of things can I do to help support her and prepare her for that?
Well, I would say, I mean, when I was growing up, I did a ton of reading. I know that's really basic, but every... you know, writer I've talked to, every MFA class I've taken, every, you know, everything says the more that you read, the better writer you will be, basically. The more you will sort of learn what to do, what you love, and what not to do. And, you know, I kept a lot of journals. You know, that's always fun. I know that there are writing programs and writing contests and you know, I think the thing about writing is that you just have to keep doing it, and you have to, you know, even if you think it's bad, you kind of have to just keep writing and writing and writing. There are a lot of great books. I can't think of names of any of them, but there are sort of writing exercise books for kids out there that sort of get your creative juices flowing, basically. you know, where you're kind of writing quick poems or you're writing just little writing exercises that are fun. But I really, I think the biggest one is reading. You know, read as much as you can, and because I have never met a writer who is not a reader. So, but obviously, if they're here, then then they like to read. So, but yeah, and have a thick skin. That's the other thing. As you get older as a writer, having a thick skin is being able to take criticism, you know, and improve upon it is an important thing. Mm? Two more? Okay. I don't know. Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
I think your writing style is really unique, and you include some things that I haven't really seen other writers do. I mean, I like the idea of the four girls being the narrators, and they become increasingly unreliable narrators as the books go on. They become more and more paranoid. They keep getting the giggles. I love that. I thought that was fantastic. And another thing is the smells. You always concentrate on the smells that are around them and how they actually become clues, like the banana gum.
Right.
So is that something that carries over into The Lion Game? Is that just how your style goes, or was that specific to Pretty Little Liars?
Well, I love unreliable narrators. I mean, I love reading about, you know, there aren't so many books that have unreliable narrators, but there are a couple that I really loved that I thought, you know, really played into Pretty Little Liars. But trying to think about The Lion Game and unreliable. I mean, Sutton is kind of an unreliable narrator because she doesn't remember a lot, and you know, even what is given to her in her memories, we're not really sure if it's true because she's only seeing like little snippets of things. So it's like, even if you see, just try and imagine you have no memory and you see a little piece of your memory, you can't make much of a judgment on that single memory, you know, as to what will happen next. So, I mean, that's kind of fun, and that's sort of psychological in its own way. Smells as clues. I mean, I just try to be really descriptive. You know, and I think that's another big thing about writing in general, is be as descriptive and specific as possible. So, you know, I think Allie's banana gum may have come out of just trying to evoke this very specific world and then realizing, oh, wait, that's actually a good clue, you know, and it was Maya's banana gum. Allie had the vanilla soap, yes. So there's lots of smells. I am sure there are smells in The Lion Game. In fact, I think in The Lion Game, too, there's a smell of sunscreen that sort of follows her around. So, and she's trying to search for the killer, so it's very much like, you know, is it a clue? Is it not a clue? Is it just her mind? Is she losing, you know? I really like writing about characters who are slowly losing their minds, actually. But yeah, no, I would say that it does carry over. And yeah, I mean, I think that is just a little bit of me just trying to be as descriptive as possible. But thank you. Okay, so one more, and then we're done.
Do you watch Pretty Little Liars?
Of course I do. Do you have a follow-up question to that? Yes, I watch the show. I watch the show every week. I'll tell you one thing, since we didn't touch on it. I went to the set last year in L.A., and I got to meet all of the girls, and all the girls are really, really nice. Aria, Lucy Hale is tiny. She's really small and adorable, and Shay Mitchell is Canadian, and she just started. This is her first acting job, and she moved from I think Toronto to LA, and now she's having a wonderful life. Troyanne comes from sort of a Hollywood family, and she's very street smart. And Ashley Benson, who plays Hannah, is really sweet, and I think she's the youngest. But she's really, really sweet, and they're all really sweet. The nicest person that I met on set, besides the girls, was Toby. The guy that plays Toby was so nice, and he had read all of the books, and he was just, like, so into being on the show. But for the most part, everybody was into being on the show, which was really nice. There weren't any divas. There weren't any, you know, attitudes of, like, you know, people throwing things and storming off. And I didn't see any of that. Everybody seemed really happy, which is kind of a nice thing. So I'm going back, actually, in 2 weeks. Last year I had a cameo. which was its own bizarre kind of thing. this year I'm just going to watch. So is that it? Thank you guys for coming out in this awful weather. You guys are awesome. And I guess we'll sign? And thank you for all your questions.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got some people come out.
What's that?
So we got some people to come out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.